I think there are three chapters to our history. One is the black history and the fact that it is 65,000 year old and that the scientific evidence tells us all of that. Then there's the colonial history and the history that white Australia was formed and how it was formed. And then there's the multicultural chapter of where we live today. And I think in order to heal, we have to accept all three chapters. Mm. We have to understand that we collectively make up all of those chapters. And to heal our nation, extending our hand out to each of those three threads is the way that we bring this together. And I think when we create that as a nation, we will essentially build a nation that we can all be proud of. I'm a proud Australian too, and I want to be able to say how proud I am of all three of those chapters, and that the nation's parliament, where I was, my workplace, represents all three of those elements. And the reflective diversity, it's the most diverse parliament we've ever had in its lifetime, has to be a reflection of our society, but also a reflection of our story.
Welcome to Season 3 of Her Story. This series delves into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'll be with you each week as we get to know these remarkable women whose lives have had a profound impact on communities throughout this state they choose to call home. Together, we will meet women who are cultural and environmental custodians, women in STEM and in business, women who care for the health and well-being of those around them. Women who are changing the world from right here in WA. Dorinda Cox is a proud Yamaji Noongar woman who in 2022 became the first female Indigenous senator to represent Western Australia. She has a 20-year history of working at local, national and international levels, representing the needs of First Nations communities. In 2023, she was inducted into the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This is Season 3, Episode 11 of Her Story with Dorinda Cox. This is her story. Did you grow up in Cojonup, or did
I was probably about 6 months old when Mum and Dad came to Perth. Yeah. So, no, I didn't have the privilege of living up in the country. But I feel like it still pulses through my veins. Like, whenever I go home, I feel this sense of, like, I'm home, you know? Like, you still have that country vibe about you anyway. Like, you slow down a lot from the fast pace of walking Pitt Street in Sydney or even St George's Terrace in Perth. Like, just a different stroll and stride about you that I think never leaves you, if that makes sense. And when you're there, you're just there. You don't worry about time or anything like that. It's a bit of a bubble, I think. And, yeah, I really like it because it's quite relaxing to just be home. And
of course, I guess the thing is that you are a Noongar Yamaji woman.
I am.
Who has a different connection to that land than I do as a white woman. For people who aren't maybe from WA, can you explain a little bit about what it means to be a Noongar Yamaji woman in WA today?
Yeah, I think for me, being a Noongar Yamaji woman is quite a unique experience because I think of it as someone who has their feet in two camps because of just the sheer geographical size of country or land for us and the diversity of that land when you think about it from an agricultural perspective even, like the dry arid parts of Wadjuri country, which is out at Boorungara. And the home of the largest rock in Australia is quite a unique experience to going to somewhere like, you know, even the Gap in Albany or in Denmark, or like the terrain's very different, but the soil's different, the people are different, towns are different. There's a different history to all of that as well. And so when you sort of weave your way from down south and the Great Southern up to the Midwest Gascoyne area, which is where my grandfather was born, it's a very different vibe. One, it's a lot hotter, but also it's just a different cultural experience even. And so you have to learn pretty quickly what that looks like. It's a different language group. There are different names for things, even though we have commonalities. But you also have to understand what is the unique history that lives in that place for us as First Peoples. And so in Noongar country, you know, there's 30,000 odd people, and, you know, we're about the size of Spain, you know, in relation to geographical size. And then you go to the Midwest coast, and or even, you know, inland to the Murchison Gascoyne, and just Wadjuri country alone is the size of Tasmania. So, like, to have a deep appreciation for that, you sort of have to step back a little bit and then understand all the cultural layers that exist in that. And that I don't think there are many towns like Burungara in the Great Southern who are without being able to drink their local water. So you're on bottled water in that. Like, that's a really different and unique experience. And so for me, when I go there, you really have to humble yourself to get an understanding of what that looks like to live in a town or a community that struggles, that struggles to maintain its population, to maintain its infrastructure with very little support. So the fuel, food, water, and energy security are big problems in communities like that, which again is quite unique from Kojonupple, even from Uwat country, where my mum's from in Eunosha. So, and that of course has its own history with the mission sites and what that meant.
Because, you know, when I talk about being born in Kojonup and my family farming that land, I'm talking about kind of six generations of settlers farming that land, and our sad story that was passed on to me as a child was that this farm was broken up because there wasn't enough money in it to be able to support all the children, so it had to be sold. And so that was kind of the sad story that I was given. But that is a very different experience to your story, in which, you know, you just mentioned your grandfather. Your six generations were all taken from family.
Yeah, that's right. And so when you think about that removal from family, from country, from your essential connection to everything that matters to you, it's a real deep severing, I think it is, in a human way. To get a deep appreciation for that, you actually have to live and walk that. I don't think people actually can. I think we can all empathise, but it's very, very different to actually feeling that deep connection of what that means. And my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, who was removed from country, was taken as a six-month-old baby. So I had a very different experience moving from Kojonup as a six-month-old baby to a big city like Perth, but he was taken to a mission and so and removed and had his name changed. And that's a very different experience. And I think people still in 2024 in this country don't have a real deep appreciation for what that's meant. We've had many inquiries, we've had many reports, and we still have this lack of education and recognition that this is actually not that far away from me in two generations, but going back before that, what that meant. So my great-grandfather was an Irish cattle station owner and owned Dairy Creek Station. So I come from Irish stock as well, which means that I also have a different connection to my ancestry and to my DNA in a way that is the story of what happened in Ireland and when my ancestors came here. And so, you know, all of that interconnected past also makes me who I am. So it's a deep-seated aspect of trauma, I suppose, that is carried through like a baton to you through the generations of, you know, your upbringing. But it's a huge amount of resilience and huge amount of active resistance that has meant that we've survived, you know, five generations of being part of the Stolen Generation. And I think for me, there's a real deep-seated connection of why I entered into politics too, I suppose.
I'm talking to you on the 31st of January, so we're just 5 days after the 26th, which is known by a whole bunch of different names. I guess, you know, officially it's Australia Day, but we also call it Survival Day and Invasion Day. And you contributed a piece to The Guardian this year that talked about the ways that this date can be used for recognition of that past and looking towards a more healed future. What does that healed future look like for you?
I think the healed future, you know, it's hard to say that you imagine waking up one day and that, you know, bam, you're healed. You know, like it just, I don't think that anybody in this country, including me, believes that that's what's going to happen for all of us. But what I do think is that there's a transition point that we're at right now, and that we've been through a huge process together as a nation, as a collective nation, of a referendum. We asked Australians to really think about what that meant in the future and what was possible. And I think we all had a vision in our minds about, wow, we'll wake up on October 15 and everything will be right and we'll move forward. And it didn't quite play out like that. And I think that we were so heavily invested, and I say we as in a majority of First Nations people, there were people who voted differently for different reasons, but I think all of us collectively believed that change was possible, and that I think the people who voted yes would have been, like the First Nations people who voted yes would have been happy if the yes got over, because there still would have been something we gained. What I was hoping is that broader Australia understood the 65,000-year-old gain that they were getting in that process. But it didn't happen like that. And healing for me and healing a nation has to be about truth-telling. Like, we have to really ground ourselves in a conversation which can be uncomfortable, can be difficult. It can really take us on a journey of, wow, I didn't understand that, to, are you sure that really happened? Like, it has to be a process that is led by us, and I mean all of us. We have to, one, try and co-lead that alongside the broader Australian society, but they also have to want to accept that this is really what happened in Australia and in modern day Australia, you know, and the fact that I think there are three chapters to our history. One is the Black history, and the fact that it is 65,000-year-old and that the scientific evidence tells us all of that. Then there's the colonial history and the history that white Australia was formed and how it was formed. And then there's the multicultural chapter of where we live today. And I think in order to heal, we have to accept all three chapters. Mm. We have to understand that we collectively make up all of those chapters, and to heal our nation, extending our hand out to each of those three threads is the way that we bring this together. And I think when we create that as a nation, we will essentially build a nation that we can all be proud of. I think we as proud Australians still continue to tell ourselves that we are proud Australians, and that we somewhere in the back of our minds still think on Invasion Day, Survival Day, Australia Day, January 26th, whatever you call it, we still have this lump in the back of our throats that still plagues us every year. And I think this year the momentum really lifted because it is the first major national event we've had since the referendum. Culture wars were live and fiery, and there were plenty that got caught in the crossfire, like Woolies, for instance. But, you know, like, I'm a proud Australian too, and I want to be able to say how proud I am of all three of those chapters, and that the nation's parliament, where I was, my workplace, represents all three of those elements. And the reflective diversity, it's the most diverse parliament we've ever had in its lifetime, has to be a reflection of our society, but also a reflection of our story. And I think that we're on the road to that. I just hope some people sit down and be a lot quieter than others on some days, but also that it's our job collectively to be allies to each other and say, hey, you know, like, that's out of line, not just from a racism point of view, but also protecting our allies and moving forward together, because we have bigger fights to fight, the global movement of what's happening in other countries. So whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Palestine, whether it's West Papua, like, there are continued issues that need our attention and that are gaining momentum. And I think there has to be a day when we as a healed nation can actually say we're a good ally to everyone else by looking in our own backyard and healing that.
We've talked about truth and truth telling, and we've talked about humility and existing and living in places that are struggling. Truth and humility are really important to you, and so is justice. I'm interested in the beginnings of your career, and that to me seems very, very tied to this idea of justice, because when you were 17, you became an Indigenous liaison police officer. I've got those words in the wrong order.
Yep.
An Indigenous police liaison officer. What was it that drew you to that role at 17?
Yeah, I think I was the sort of kid who loved to do new things, and my parents were always... I was the kid who always asked questions like, why does that happen? What do we do different? Like, and so I was a very inquisitive young person from a really young age. And I think my dad in particular always thought I would get really easily bored. And so he was the person who was always on the lookout for things for me to do. And I was very sporty. And so I was playing a lot of basketball, a lot of netball, training 6 or 7 days a week. And my dad had lots of friends who were in the police. And he was the person who encouraged me to think about a career in the police. And he talked about it in the way of a career. Anyway, he got one of his mates to come over one night and for dinner. And me thinking it was quite innocent that he was having a catch-up with a friend. In fact, this guy turned up with some application forms. So I was really cornered into a conversation about what my future looked like as a young person. And my dad pretty much sat me down and said, I don't think you'll get another opportunity where you're going to be able to have so many experiences and to really find yourself and find something that you like. And that you are always a fair and honest person. Like, I always was the person who would referee, whether it be a basketball or referee things that were happening, disputes in my own household or my friends. So my dad always saw that as a real strength of mine. So he was like, you'd be a great police officer. You know, think about what that would look like. And I reluctantly said yes. And I say reluctantly because I went in that as a very, very naive 17-year-old, thinking that I would change the world. Mm. And I, in fact, didn't. And so at the end of that 8.5, nearly 9 years in that place, I got a sense of failure. Like, I felt like I'd let people down. I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve in that. And I think that's for me, a real reflection of what failure or success looks like for people, and what you set your heart on doing before you go into any sort of process or any job or any relationship. You have a sense of, these are the things I want to achieve and these are the things I want to do. And when that doesn't happen, you have this real letdown, like your heart sinks a little bit and you think, God, where did I go wrong? Mm. What choices did I make during that time? Or was there things that I missed? Or if I had my time again, what would I do different? And so I think that sense for me of what justice looks like as well was a really important reflection to take away from that. And justice was about the criminal justice system in that job. It's not about justice. And so it's for me, the big takeaway is that we are having a different conversation from what the reality is.
Which again ties into this idea of truth telling, because that was my next question was, when we look at that role that's within the police force, there must have been some conflicts between, like some internal conflicts for you, between acknowledging that your role was very much tied up in a settler idea of law and right and wrong and justice, and then having to be that liaison with your own community.
Absolutely. And I would have to say that would have been a daily thing. Like you get into you wake up every day and you get into uniform and you're almost robotic. Like you almost kick into autopilot and you become a person who's indoctrinated into exactly that settler, colonialist way of viewing the world. And you go to the station and you have the same conversations and you're... But I think for me, I was constantly, and the older I got, the more aware I became of where are the differences? Where are the things I can change, and where are the things I can improve this system from the inside? And what I quickly realised is there was a big system that all fitted in like a big pipeline to each other, and that each part of those pipeline, there were people clicking their tickets and things were happening that were beyond my control. But for me, it was the little things I could do every day that made a difference. So one example that I always use is when I took people into custody. Custodial care is exactly that. It's care. It's care for another human being. And I would quite often say to people, I might be here as somebody who's in a liaison position, but I need to know all of the information that allows me to care for you while you're here. And that included people's medical conditions, if they hadn't eaten, things we needed to be aware of, if they had any worries, how they were feeling, within themselves. And that's all in the Royal Commission on Deaths in Custody, as the backdrop to that. But my really important job in that was to understand and try and teach others that it isn't just a tick and flick box exercise, that your care has to extend to the humanity that is within that, and that people like John Pat and their first experience as a young person with police should be a good experience. It shouldn't be inside a lockup, and it shouldn't be screaming to the top of your lungs and ringing a buzzer to get help because someone has failed to ask the series of questions that are required to ensure that you have good care. And so I was always very mindful of that. I also came up against many challenges like people not seeing past the uniform. And I became acutely aware in my early days that people didn't see me. They saw a uniform, they saw a badge, they saw a car, they didn't see you as a person. And that to me was a big barrier in achieving the things that I want to achieve and wanted to achieve when I was there, because people had to see you. They had to see that you had an enormous amount of humility and enormous amount of integrity in the way that you work. And if they don't see that, there's no point. You are continuing to just be another robot on the line that was there to do a job. And for me, I met an extraordinary amount of people who had a lot of compassion and a lot of drive for change. But there's a bigger system than us, and that it was a constant struggle to keep your head above water in trying to make that change.
It's a system that does not encourage critical thinking.
Absolutely not.
And for someone who, like you, who is curious and is asking questions about why are things done this way and does have a deep kind of philosophical bent to them, that must have been a real struggle. When you were leaving that job and leaving that system, did you know that politics was going to be your next step, or were you like, where am I going now?
I think, no, it was where am I going now? And I needed to come back home. I was living in Kalgoorlie at the time, so I was off country. And a lot of that was a very unsettled soul, if I can put it in that way, that I needed to be home on my own country. And that I was working and living on somebody else's country, and that I was essentially a visitor to that place and wanted to create some space for someone local. But when I came home, I did a lot of soul searching. I had 3 months off work, and I did a lot of that real deep thinking about where do I want to go next. And politics didn't even cross my mind. It wasn't until some years later that I joined a political party, and that I started to think about a career in politics and really started to understand that it had been a calling for a really long time. And I think when you have some of those experiences where people to refer to it as deja vu, but like the penny drops for you and you go, oh, wow, that's what that meant when I was doing that thing many, many years ago. And now I can see why that's come around in a different way, and I have a different view about it, or I know that it has a deeper meaning for me. So I also visited Parliament House when I was 17 and before I joined the police, but it was a place where I didn't see any black politicians. So it for me is, you know, it meant something further down the track. So when I reenacted that picture some 30 odd years later, which is quite quite a stark sort of contrast, that I was 17 in one photo and then I was, inducted, when I was about 45. So, you sort of worlds away. You've had kids, you've had, different life experiences, travelled overseas, you've done all this stuff, and then you come back full circle and all of a sudden you're sitting in that same chair again and you think, wow, okay, I'm a different person now and I now understand what this all means.
And you're also a 45-year-old woman in a new career, which goes against everything that society tells us as women in our kind of shelf life, that by the time we are 40, we're either in this career that we'll do for the rest of our lives, or we're mothers that will be doing this and just kind of fading away into obscurity. And you've gone, actually, no. I am now Senator Dorinda Coggs and I'm sitting in this chair. What is that like for you as a mother of teenage girls and preteen girls to say to them, what you do now shapes your future, but also doesn't dictate exactly what that future looks like?
Yeah, I think it's a very big learning curve being a parent of daughters. I just want to say that first. But, and I always say to my mum, I hope I was never this much of a handful to you. But, you're right. My girls are very acutely aware that they don't have a normal teenage life either, that they are the mum, the daughters of a politician, and their mum travels a bit. And, when they say they're coming to their mum's workplace, it's Parliament House, which could be a real jolt to the reality of the life that they have to live. They don't get to have some of the same experiences other preteens do, and they sometimes have to miss out on the birthday parties because mum's got a rally to go to. And so that some of those things they're acutely aware of, but there's also that bigger picture stuff which I quite often tell them about and encourage them to always be open to new things. Always think about, if I wanted to do something in my future, the one thing I should hold on to is that it matters to people. And you can never go wrong, right? Mm. Like if it matters to the broader community and you feel like you've achieved something, then do it. Like it doesn't matter if you're an astronaut, it doesn't matter if you're a zookeeper or a politician, it doesn't matter that you are making a difference in somebody's life or something's life that is going to have impact And so I try and raise my children with the forethought of making sure that they have a vision for themselves, and that not only the way the world they want the world to see them, but the way they see the world. And so, you know, I've obviously grounded a lot of it in their link to the environment. Their placentas are buried on country under an olive tree in my mother's country. And so I've grounded them in a very, people would say, environmental or sustainable way that is about that understanding the spiritual aspect of our connection to country. But I also want them to think much broader about what's the impact, what's happening around us, and do we have any control over that? And I quite often tell them there are things you don't have control over, and you have to make some peace with that. But the people power also has a large amount of power in it if we can calibrate it in the right way, if we can harness it and the energy of people. And collective energy is a really powerful tool that we can use in our community. So my kids have grown up with a constant bit of movement in their life, but their stability has always been their home and their family and the things that in their country that enables us to still pivot very clearly into some of the things of their aspirations and their dreams of where they want to be. And I think that'll change this year with, you know, one of them going to high school and the other one still being in primary school, that there's this very organic feeling in the house at the moment this week of, well, having a big kid. And so, you know, what that means for her in her future, I talk to her quite a lot about. And it's the new generation of technology where kids who start high school now have all got mobile phones and, you know, I got the, "Mum, I'll just text you" conversation. And I was thinking, I can just see that I will be sitting in question time getting a million texts from my daughter, which I could only imagine will just be amazing and heartfelt. But also, yeah, I might have to chat to her about, like, you know, the time changes and, you know, the things that we all need to have the rules in our lives and pay attention when it's required. But at the moment, it just feels quite uplifting when you've had a lot of time, school holidays, just to be grounded again, understand where you're going, and then make a plan for what you're going to do this year.
As someone who exists between multiple worlds and who lives their lives asking these questions, not only for yourself but for other people, where do you find the space to be Jorinda, and just where do you find that joy of being alive for yourself?
I think I find time, and I'm a morning person. I never ever was as a teenager, as a, you know, person in my 20s even, but I've become a real morning person. And so I like to get out in, you know, the fresh air really early in the morning, go for a walk, have my breakfast outside somewhere, just to put my feet on the ground and just to feel that being alive and that connection to where I am. And so when I'm in Canberra, I'm usually, you know, out on the balcony and having breakfast and, like, just trying to envisage what the day looks like. And I think that's my quiet time in my mind, but also in my heart. Like, I get to slow down and I get to just be present in that moment. And so I normally stay close to the foreshore in Canberra, so I find a lot of time in that. I've got a chocolate Labrador at home, and so he loves to wake me up at 5:30 in the morning and just jump up on my bed and spend time as I sort of scroll through, you know, what the day might look like. And so Charlie has this wonderful skill of being able to lick your feet and to wake you up in the morning, which I sort of miss when I'm not at home. But I find a lot of joy in being with my kids and being with my family. That's just my time to be me. I'm not a politician. I'm not someone who has to sort of be mindful of the way people see me in public, or not that I am, because I try and be as authentic as possible. But it's being in public life is always about people knowing who you are and you know, they have an expectation, I suppose, of the way you'd present yourself. So when I'm with my family, and whether it's going out for ice cream or going to a movie or just being out and about, I try and do that in a way where I'm really present for them. Like, I don't spend my time looking at my phone. I've got structure in my calendar and my diary where I can say during these times, like, which is Saturday usually, I'm a basketball mum, right? So nothing happens on a Saturday unless it's urgent. And I think unless you give yourself permission to do that, people will impose on your private life and then your personal life to mould you into somebody that's 24/7 a politician and is on call and on demand. And I think I've really wanted to make sure that my family understand my political life, but also that my political life understands that I'm a mum and I'm a family member and I'm a community member, and I have to make time for all of those other elements that are complementary to that.
Her story is a focus on women who have been inducted to the WA Women's Hall of Fame, which is a great honour. What are you most proud of from your career as a politician? What's been your biggest honour that you've just gone, yes, that's the thing?
I think probably one of the biggest things has been triggering the inquiry into missing and murdered First Nations women and children. Like, I, in my first speech, signalled that this is something that I needed to happen in Australia. It's Australia's first inquiry on this issue. After travelling to Canada and talking to Canadian women in particular, and the Native Women's Association, about the 400 or 500 missing, murdered women and girls, and brought that back to Australia and started listening and researching all of the stuff that was happening here and going, my God, like, we have a huge problem, as did Canada have as well, before they triggered their own Royal Commission-style inquiry. So the moment I was getting ready to come into politics, I thought there has to be, this is the moment in time, this is the one thing I can do to shed light on this issue and to actually make change that is meaningful. Because it's not just the woman that's been murdered this year or last year, it is over generations of women and children, and some that are still missing that people don't have any answers for. And so I can be really proud that I've almost created a platform that people who are the survivors can come forward and tell us some of the things they've never been able to say. Like, they've never been able to talk to the media. They've never been able to talk to authorities or authority figures about the way they felt and the impact it's had on them. And for me, that's a real stain, I suppose, upon our history, that we haven't valued the lives of those women and children. And that, as a parliamentarian, that's my job. My job is to create a space in an inquiry to hear those people's voices. And when you do that, you have a sense of, wow, this is really going to be really powerful. And I don't think I really realised that nearly 2.5 years ago when I made that call in my first speech, that it would be so powerful. And even today, you know, we're seeing there are still people being charged for women that have gone missing, and 10 years on. And that gives me a sense of hope. It gives me a sense of I'm doing something that matters. I'm doing something that's creating change. It's allowing the system to take a really good look at itself and to understand the impact that it's had on families and communities in Australia, and particularly First Nations communities. And I think that once we're through to the end of this inquiry at the end of June, we'll see some good recommendations on that. There are so many smaller moments, I suppose, in politics where you can say, well, we had a win and that was great, and things that I've been involved in. But I think that the inquiry in itself will bring about change that I think will be life-changing for a lot of people.
Dorinda, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us here at RTRFM for her story today. Given that you have so many other things that are demanding your attention. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to Senator Dorinda Cox and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women and femmes who make her story on RTRFM happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Rachel Ang and Madeline Mitchell are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Her Story is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of the land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. I'm Beck Bowman. Join me next week for a special musical finale of Season 3 of Her Story, with special guest and 2024 Women's Hall of Fame inductee,